Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of The Beanpot. I'm thrilled to be able to continue this journey for another season and excited to explore several new topics that will hopefully help us all to see our world from new perspectives. My first episode of the season is largely about food and how it shapes and is shaped by our culture. It's no secret that food is essential to all life. But have you ever wondered why you eat the foods you eat? Why your parents or grandparents made certain meals? Or maybe why the same food is prepared differently from one family to the next? My guest, Emily Blavos, explores this fascinating intersection of food and culture in her book, The Story of Alabama in 14 Foods. In this interview, we talk about what led her to the idea for the book and how her creative process and research brought the traditions and stories of the state's past into focus. We talk about several of our favorite chapters and stories, including gumbo, banana pudding, and boiled peanuts, just to name a few. I don't think I've ever dug so deeply into the backstory of food before. I found it deeply moving to think about how creative people had to be in the past just to make tasty meals. We just take it for granted that we can walk into almost any store and grab a ready-made meal that will feed our whole family. The process of where it came from and how it was made is almost completely lost on us. And honestly, we barely scratched the surface because I also wanted to talk about her nonfiction writing. We touched briefly on her most recent middle grades book called Like Nothing Amazing Ever Happened, which I highly recommend. It's a story about a young boy whose father dies and the complexity of how the other people around him deal with this loss. And beyond just being a well-told story, Emily really challenges the reader to see the things that most people overlook, to really think about our life and the rich history of the places we live and the people that came before us. Without a doubt, I finished this interview feeling inspired to be creative and to explore my community and the stories of the people who lived here before. I hope that you will find something similar and that you will read her books and recommend them to others. Please visit my website, adamdrinkwater.com, for links to my podcast, blog, and social media. And check out the show notes for how you can learn more about Emily and her books at emilyblavos.com. So with that, let's get started. So you're actually my first interview for this second season.
Yay!
You're originally from Minnesota, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to Mobile, Alabama?
Well, we moved to Alabama in 2004. My husband got a job in Montgomery, and I went to grad school at that point at Auburn and I was studying rural sociology, which is not a term that most people have ever heard of, but there are rural social programs around the country, and it was just an awesome experience. And I had a minor in economic development, and so I was really interested in heritage tourism and sort of just like you're talking about, you know, the stories that we tell and how can we kind of use our history and our culture in order to boost economic development. That's kind of how I came into this work. And originally, I felt like we really needed a civil rights trail guide because there was so basically I was just studying everything I could about Alabama. My dad and all my grandparents are from the South. And so the South wasn't completely foreign to me. But I had never lived in the South. I definitely didn't know much about Alabama. And so I just kind of jumped in and was trying to learn everything I could. And I felt like if we had some kind of civil rights trail guide, it would let people come in and see these sites more easily and make them more accessible. They're pretty well marked in places like Montgomery and Birmingham, but there's a lot that happened out in the Black Belt that just isn't marked. And so I kind of took it upon myself to do that research, and I traveled all around. I read all the books. I put it together, and I presented it to the University of Alabama Press. And they were like, you know, you've done good work here, but we already have a book like this. in the works. And there's we can't publish it. There's nothing we can do with it. So I love telling that story because I think sometimes people see a book cover and it's, you know, and they did a nice job with the design of this food book. And it's a beautiful book. And it just, you get it in your head that it was just this straight trajectory, you know, and it was a zigzaggy path. I hit all kinds of brick walls and had to maneuver my way around. And I especially love telling that to young people because I think, you know, I didn't hear that enough when I was in high school and college, that you're gonna hit dead ends, you're gonna have to hustle, and you're gonna have to navigate, and you're gonna have to figure out a different way. And so luckily, in that same conversation, the editor at UA Press said, you know, but we love this idea of a trail. Can you think of a different kind of trail that you would want to do? You know, like a gardening trail or a sports trail, or what about a food trail? And I thought, okay, you know, maybe I could figure out a food trail. And that was interesting to me. You know, ultimately, I wanted to write a book about Alabama history and culture. And so I thought I could use food as a way into those stories. So I didn't really want to do a cookbook because I felt like that had been done a lot and really well. And at that time, there was like food travelogues were really big, you know, where you just ride around and eat stuff and write about it. And I didn't want to do that either because I felt like that had been done. But I thought, you know, I could write a book telling different Alabama stories and sort of the history of Alabama using food as a way into that history. So that was an idea that, first of all, I didn't have on my own. You know, it was just a question that got me thinking. And then secondly, it was a really organic process as I started to go about it. You know, I would be interested in this food, but I wouldn't really find the hook. And then I would find something else here. And ultimately, you know, it turned into this book, but it was a windy road. But in the end, I really wanted to tell Alabama stories, and I wanted to convey the amazing amount of diversity in our state, culturally, geographically, environmentally, historically. I mean, so much goes on within Alabama's borders. And I think, you know, not being from Alabama, being raised in Minnesota, I was always, but with Southern grandparents and a Southern dad, I was always well aware of the stereotypes. And so that was kind of in the back of my mind, wanting to put a book out there that shows everything that's happening in our state, you know, kind of beyond, you know, cotton and fried chicken and those tropes that are so easy to reach for, you know, and fried chicken is in the book because it's really important. But there was a lot of other things, you know, happening too. A lot of really localized traditions, a lot of stories that, you know, we don't hear every day. There's a chapter on Biola Battery, which of course is the population there is comprised of one third Southeast Asian immigrants, you know, from Cambodia and Vietnam and Laos. There are three Buddhist temples in Biola Battery. There are Asian grocery stores. I mean, that's not something that, you know, I think the rest of the country may think about when they think about Alabama. And so I was conscious of wanting to bring those cultures and those stories to light. That's a very long answer to your question, but
no,
it requires a lot of backstory.
It does. And I think the stories you choose, and the foods that you choose in the book give a backstory that's really important for understanding the culture that we have now.
Right.
For instance, your very first chapter about the Creek Nation and about roasted corn. Growing up in the North, we studied, you know, the Iroquois nations and the native tribes and cultures that were close to where we grew up. I didn't grow up really learning about the Creek Nation and its diversity and their way of life. And so I feel like that's something, because I didn't grow up here and I don't have that backstory, I hear creek and it doesn't mean anything to me. I think of a stream, right? Like that, somebody says creeks and I think stream, and there's no history. There's no meaning. It doesn't carry any weight with me. But to realize that there were a people here before us who made their homes in these areas brings brings it to a new light, I guess, and makes me think about it differently. What did you learn just from that first chapter about roasted corn?
Oh, the Creek history is so long and so detailed and so interesting. I think the part of it that's interesting to me, so the Battle of Horseshoe Bend took place on Alabama soil. Andrew Jackson was loomed large in that battle, and his exploits during the Creek War sort of propelled him to the presidency. So part of kind of his history in Alabama allowed him to be president. And as president, of course, he pushed through Indian removal in 1830. One thing that I was really interested in about Indian removal is that it was a highly contested piece of legislation. There were a lot of people who were against it. And I think sometimes when we look back and history seems inevitable, but it definitely wasn't, and there were a lot of people who didn't want to see that happen. And so at that time, people thought, you know, people who were non-Native and were left in Alabama didn't think that there were any Native Americans left in Alabama. You know, you had no reason to self-identify as Creek or as Choctaw or as Chickasaw because there was so much discrimination and so limited, such limited opportunity. So, but there were groups of Native Americans that remained, small groups. And so from about 1830 to 1930, for the Creeks, you know, their heritage just wasn't brought to the surface. And so when they started doing more kind of genealogy research to do that research to get their federal designation as a tribe, and when they started looking at land for a reservation, and then you had the civil rights movement, the American Indian movement, you know, all of those things kind of happening where they were starting to take pride in their Creek heritage again, all the way up until today when they have this, you know, they're the only federally recognized tribe in Alabama, the only federally recognized reservation. And they have this Thanksgiving powwow every year with all these dancers, and they have a lot of cultural activity now. They're learning the language again. They're doing traditional craft, Creek crafts. All of that came back, you know, from this really small group. And I think it's such a heartwarming story. And it's such an important part. I mean, almost all of present day Alabama was part of the Creek Nation. So, you know, for a very long time, hundreds of years. And so that history is really important to us as a state. But it was almost lost. And it just kind of goes to show what just even a small band of people can do if you're committed to your identity and where you come from. In fact, when they first started, one of my favorite stories about the Creek is when they first start in Alabama, it had been underground for so long that they didn't even really know kind of how to revitalize it. And so they went to Oklahoma and learned from the Creeks who had been displaced. And those traditions had been kept stronger because they had more people. And so their Oklahoma brethren kind of taught them a lot about their own history, which I thought was kind of cool. But yeah, that's a really important piece. And I see more and more organizations and just individuals taking the time and effort to recognize the fact that we are all on, you know, borrowed land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we barely rent the space that we have, and we have it mm-hmm. for such a short time. It's easy to, it's easy to grab onto a piece of dirt that you're standing on and think, oh, this is mine, and not realize how many people have come before you that have stood on that same dirt or used mm-hmm. that same dirt for something totally different. And I realized that Alabama isn't unique because of its land and its resources, although it is. It's unique because of the cultures that live within its borders and their own individual histories and their shared histories, their individual cultures and shared cultures. And I think I also learned that recently, because of the even chapter two in your book about gumbo. Mm-hmm. I had a totally different idea about gumbo, what it is, where it came from, why we have it. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of gumbo and what that means to our state?
Yeah, I like gumbo a lot as a tradition, you know, included in the book, because it really represents the definition of Southern food, which is a mix of cultures. Mm. It's Southern food exists because Native American, African American, and European American food traditions fused. Mm-hmm. And that's cooking techniques, ingredients, you know, environment, all of that. But that's really why Southern food exists, is because it's that blend. And gumbo is a perfect representation of that, because it has ingredients from all over the world. It has local, you know, seafood from the Gulf of Mexico. And the other thing about gumbo that's cool is that it's unique to every person who makes it. You know, everyone kind of puts their own touch to it. And you can make it. Originally, it was kind of made, you know, from leftover stuff, you know, scraps, whatever you had on hand, whatever you could catch, you know, whatever you could find to put in the pot. And all stews, you know, can feed a lot of people with not necessarily expensive ingredients. Now, when you make gumbo, it is quite an expensive endeavor, but that's not how it started. You know, it started by being a way of using what you had to feed your family and feed your community. Particularly in Mobile, you know, gumbo represents the Creole culture, which is huge on the Gulf Coast. And in a lot of ways, the Gulf Coast history is different than inland history. That's true for Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana, because of the European and Catholic heritage along the Gulf Coast. There was more interracial mixing. The laws and the attitudes were more lenient, and so there was this huge, prosperous Creole culture that emerged in Mobile. And gumbo is always kind of the signature dish of Creole culture in Mobile, and it still is the signature dish of Creole Mardi Gras and African American Mardi Gras in Mobile. So when you go to a Creole or African American Mardi Gras party, you'll always find gumbo, you'll always find ham and red beans and rice and potato salad, but gumbo is kind of that main dish and represents that heritage. So it has a special place in Mobile.
And I like what you said about, you know, the cultures coming together, and we wouldn't have any of these foods or if the cultures weren't blended. And we don't know that unless we know our history, right? Like, it's easy to create our own myths and our own stories about where this food came from. And so knowing the history of it, I think actually makes it more rich and more interesting, just to know that backstory.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are reasons that we eat the foods that we eat, you mm-hmm. know, cultural reasons, environmental reasons, growing season, economy, politics. I mean, there's so many different influences on the way we eat and what we eat. And I think that is an interesting part of all of this. Like, for instance, sweet potatoes are so huge in the South. And sweet potato pie is kind of one of the staples of soul food. And sweet potatoes are really a food of survival. They're very easy to grow and store. They can last forever in a pile of leaves. You know, they can last all winter. They're super high, you know, in nutrients. And so sweet potatoes fed a lot of people and prevented a lot of people from hunger, you know, of all races and classes in the South, you know, during hard times. Most Southerners were subsistence farmers. You know, that's another sort of thing that we think about the South. When we're not from the South, we think about plantations and slavery, and that was absolutely a part of our history and something, of course, that we're still continuing many people, Many whites, however, were farmers. You know, the white plantation owners were the minority. And so a lot of white Southerners lived on the farm and grew, you know, and lived on what they had. And so sweet potatoes were an important part of that, and for everybody. So, you know, when you have sweet potato pie on Thanksgiving in the South, instead of, you know, pumpkin pie like you might have in the North, there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in African-American culture, you know, West Africans were used to cooking with the yam, which is similar to a sweet potato. And so when they were enslaved and brought to this country, they applied what they knew about the yam to the sweet potato. And so there's that history as well.
I didn't know about so many foods, Southern foods, before I got here. And with the exception of those that might be culturally relevant because of a movie or because of something popular throughout all of the United States, for instance, fried green tomatoes. I think the only reason I probably know about fried green tomatoes is because there was a movie with the same title.
Right.
But there's so many other things that I hadn't experienced. I don't think that I had ever even heard of okra before I moved to the South, before, and I was in my 20s. And then to find that okra was not a native plant, if I'm not mistaken, and that it has, there's many ways that it can be eaten, and that just to experience all those things for the first time and to not grow up with stewed okra, fried okra, pickled okra, like all the different ways you can have okra, that have... Many of those things have come about because of the necessity of needing to preserve it, keep it, cook it, in an area that didn't have a lot of resources.
Yeah, and I love that you brought up okra, because that's another thing about Southern food. You know, I think people tend to think of fried chicken and barbecue, and those are obviously very important and both have their chapters in the book. But really, if you look historically, at the heart of the Southern diet is vegetables, and it always has been. You know, we're blessed with a long growing season in Alabama. We can grow all kinds of vegetables, and we always have. I mean, when, you know, people lived on the farm, the biggest meal would be in the middle of the day, and it would be mostly vegetables and cornbread, and maybe a little meat, but maybe not, you know, because meat was expensive, and fried chicken was reserved for Sundays, you know, if at all. And then, you know, during times of crisis, you know, during the Civil War, when everything got harder, people would forage and find stuff in the woods, you know. So vegetables really, if you have, and also there are certain vegetables that ripen together. And so they were always served together, like okra and tomatoes, you know, there's that saying, what grows together, goes together. And so serving fresh, ripe vegetables in certain pairings, I mean, that's really kind of what the heart of the Southern diet is about. And that's what a lot of newer chefs, you know, will tell you and are looking at sort of when they're putting together their menus and their dishes. You know, it's very vegetable-centric, which is not something a non-Southerner would come up with, I don't think.
Yeah. I think that's accurate. You live in Mobile, the Port of Mobile, and we are blessed to have one of the busiest ports in our state. I mean, in our country, within our state, and we, as a state, as a region, have gotten to experience things because of that port city. And banana pudding is obviously the one that comes to mind. And I'd never had banana pudding before. It was foreign to me. I love it. My mother-in-law makes the best banana pudding in the world. and everyone makes it slightly differently. But really that the docks or the port of Mobile is why we even have bananas in Alabama and why we can make banana pudding.
Right. And that is a history that not a lot of people know, which I find so interesting because the banana docks, you know, the first shipment of bananas arrived in Mobile in 1893. And by 1900, so 7 years later, Mobile was the largest importer of bananas in the nation, just
which
behind
just
New York
blows my mind.
And New Orleans, which is a crazy, and it really saved Mobile's economy, which was in tatters after the Civil War. You know, cotton was worth half of what it had been, and they needed to find something different. You know, the city was kind of languishing, and so it was the Chamber of Commerce who thought about imports and offered this prize to the first regular fruit shipment, and that's how bananas got to Mobile. But they really carried Mobile until World War II. So for about 40 years, they were really important. The banana docks stretched, you know, for four blocks along the waterfront. There were warehouses, there were boats, there were, you know, all that infrastructure was there. And you don't see any of that left. You don't even see a sign about it in Mobile, which is hopefully will be remedied someday because the banana docks were really important, you know, for a long time.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to remember and remember how we even got to banana pudding when we have our family get-togethers. I venture to guess that most of my in-laws have no idea why they eat banana pudding or where when it started. It was fascinating to me.
Yeah, it was just it was good timing because bananas were just kind of coming on the scene. And at first they were seen as a luxury. You know, they were this sort of icon of the tropics, and they were only bananas Foster, banana pudding, that kind of thing were only served in really highbrow hotels because bananas were expensive and hard to get. And it's hard to imagine that now.
Mm-hmm.
But then they became this sort of everyday food for us. And yeah. So it's hard to imagine that that wasn't the case.
You can't go to a buffet without banana pudding being a part of the buffet.
Yeah, exactly.
And then obviously a really important crop for Alabama is peanuts. And the boiled peanut, which I absolutely love, is something that even some of our neighbors, like in Texas and other states that are relatively close, they don't boil peanuts. Mm-hmm. What is it about boiling peanuts and the wiregrass and George Washington Carver that like really sets Alabama apart?
Yeah, that's a great question. Boiled peanuts are found predominantly in African American areas. And so where there was the highest concentration of African Americans, that's where you find boiled peanuts because, you know, African Americans would sell them as vendors. And that was one of the, few kind of economic opportunities open to them. And so a lot of the peanut vendors were African Americans, and that's why we have so many in Alabama. But the wiregrass is a little bit different story. So George Washington Carver, who is my personal hero, and I hope that comes through in the book
because
I'm just such a huge fan of his.
Mm-hmm.
He at Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University, he along with his fellow extension agents were trying to get farmers to plant crops that would give nitrogen back to the soil. The soil was totally desiccated from being overplanted in cotton for centuries. And so he was encouraging peanuts as a way to rehab the soil. And of course, peanuts provide a really nutritious, healthy snack. So for poorer farmers, you know, peanuts were a great idea. And sweet potatoes too. They also give nitrogen back to the soil. But it was a hard sell because there was a lot of tenant farming. And so the farmers who were planting the crops were not the ones making the decisions. And so in most counties, and for a lot of other reasons, people were just stuck on cotton. They felt like the prices would rebound, you know. So he didn't have a lot of success in the Black Belt, but in the wiregrass, the boll weevil had come through and eaten, I think it was like 60% of the cotton crop. And the wiregrass farmers were already amenable to doing things differently because their soil was different. And so they took on peanuts, and in 1917, they had the largest peanut harvest in the nation. And it just, they were kind of peanut crazy for several years after that. And so they, Of course, you probably know being in Troy in 1919, erected the boll weevil statue in Enterprise to in honor of the pest that forced them to diversify. And that statue celebrated its 100-year anniversary last year. But when they erected the statue, their guest of honor was actually supposed to be none other than George Washington Carver. He couldn't make it because there was heavy rain and the roads were not passable. But kind of brings it full circle. But yeah, Carver and Extension still today are about bringing everything they're learning, you know, at the universities out to the farmers who need it.
What's Extension Service? What is that for people who aren't familiar with it?
The Extension System, I think it probably exists in all 50 states. It's connected to Auburn University. And it basically, the purpose of Extension is to bring everything that we're learning about agriculture and forestry, and nutrition, everything that the scientists at the university are learning, to bring that knowledge out into the communities and the counties who need it. And in Alabama, we're lucky to have extension offices in every county of Alabama. That's not the case everywhere, but we have a county extension office in all 67 counties in Alabama, which is awesome. And so George Washington Carver took that very literally and actually created what he called a movable school. So he had a horse-drawn wagon with all of his equipment, and he would ride out, you know, into Macon County and the surrounding counties and visit the farmers where they were. So the whole idea is you don't make the farmer come to you because that's a burden on the farmer, you know, a burden of time and transportation. And so you go out to them and give them what they need. And he was an expert at doing that. And he was also a painter. He would, you know, develop paints from nature, from clay and from different plants. And he would bring the farmers, you know, flower seeds and paint. Because he also felt like he wanted to give them the tools to beautify their homesteads, you know, and help them sort of feel proud of where they lived and where they were, you know, in pretty dire circumstances.
And we have him to thank for most of our peanut uses, I guess. I can't really think of a better way to say that, but everything from peanut butter to boiled peanuts. I mean, he came up with just so many inventive ways to use the peanut.
He did. Yeah, that's kind of what he's known for, is all of those different uses. And he also, I can't remember the number now, but he also came up with a lot for pecans and a lot for sweet potatoes. And he would publish all of that in bulletins that would go out to the farmers. And he didn't patent any of his inventions or anything that he discovered, because he felt like they were God-given, and how could he take credit for something that God had given him? And so he just really was about giving all of his knowledge out to the people who needed it.
I think that's one of the things that I admire most about him, and besides the fact that he's just an amazing inventor and thinker, is just how much he was trying to better the people around him, how he was trying to improve their lives and make their lives better. Regardless of who they were or where they came from, he just wanted people's lives to be better and wanted them to have new tools and new ways of doing things that made their jobs easier.
Yeah, exactly. And he was really far ahead of his time. I mean, he was one of the first people thinking about ecology, you know, the way that things work together in a system. And if you change one thing, it affects others, you know. So, yeah, just an all around brilliant guy.
Well, the book is, to me, helped me rethink how I view the food on my table, and why we eat what we eat, why we do what we do. I can even think about just growing up in Pennsylvania, we had certain meals that were just a staple of holidays, like sauerkraut. like
right.
because of there's a heavy German influence, and so you know, to get down here and almost no one eats sauerkraut that I know. I mean, it's just not something that's culturally relevant. To learn of just those little interesting stories that help us appreciate our food and our own culture and our own history, I think is what this book has done for me in a lot of ways. Were there any other stories in the book that just really spoke to you personally, even more so than just something you wanted to share with in the book, something that impacted you, that changed your thinking?
You know, there are a couple. The first one was really turkey hunting. I went turkey hunting twice, and I loved it. And I never made the connection before I had that experience between hunters and conservation. But turkey hunters in particular, I mean, maybe all hunters, but I'll speak to turkey hunters because that's what I know. But they give generously to conservation. Both hunters that I went with knew just a ton about the natural world. And to them, hunting was really about kind of a nature experience. You know, you're thinking about the habitat, you're thinking about turkey habitat, you're thinking about the landscape where you are, you know, you're thinking about turkey habits and trying to kind of sneak up on these turkeys. And you don't usually get one. You don't maybe even usually see one. And so it can't be about, you know, bagging a turkey, because that doesn't usually happen. And it's really more about the thrill of tracking something, but also just being out in nature. And that gets passed down through families. And so when I looked at that, and I looked at the conservation movement as a whole nationally, it really began with sportsmen and with hunters who were realizing that without bag limits and game limits, game law, you know, that we were destroying our natural spaces. And it was the sportsmen who called for, you know, that all of those laws that went into effect, and a lot of the preservation that's happened. And so I had never made that connection before. It's not something that I had thought about. My dad's a pheasant hunter, but I never went with him or really, you know, dove into that as a kid. And so I was really surprised by that. And one of my other favorite stories, I think, that I stumbled upon was a story of a woman called Georgia Gilmore. She was a single mother of four in Montgomery during the bus boycott, and she was fired from her job at a local restaurant for testifying on behalf of the boycott leaders in court. And so she started cooking in her home, you know, for some of the leaders. She lived in the sort of thriving middle class neighborhood called Centennial Hill in Montgomery. So she, you know, she would cook in her home and people would meet at her house and make plans. And there was that element, but she even went further and she started something called the Club from Nowhere. And she called it that so people wouldn't discover what it was about and shut it down. But basically she went all over Montgomery selling cakes and pies, and everything she earned, she would donate back into the movement, you know, for carpool, car repair, you know, all the costs that they encouraged trying to keeping this boycott going for 13 months. And so every Monday at the mass meeting, you know, she would give her donation, and it was often the highest donation that they got every week. And she would get a standing ovation. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons to love that story, but I think, one of the biggest for me is, you know, what a difference one person can make, you know, just by figuring out, kind of like you were saying at the beginning of this conversation, what's my role? What do I bring to the table, so to speak? What can I do in this little patch of earth that I inhabit, you know, to make things better, to contribute? And she could cook, and that's what she did. And, you know, we don't hear her name as much as we hear Dr. King's name and others, but she certainly did her part.
Yeah, I think her story is is a very inspiring story, and reminds us that it's the little things that we do in our lives and the way that we affect the people around us that have more of an impact on the world than leaving your home and going to a big city and trying to make a big difference, which in some respects, I think as I was going through my own personal journey, I grew up in a very rural part of Pennsylvania and grew up next to a dairy farm and with cornfields all around me, and I hated it. And I was annoyed with my family or my parents that I had to live in this nowhere place. And why couldn't we live somewhere interesting and do something fun and special, you know, like in the big city? And so that, I think I always had kind of that goal or that dream to go and be a part of a big city and with the movers and shakers and change the world. And I realized after moving to Nashville that that's a really challenging thing to do in a city of several million people. I mean, you are a small fish in a giant pond, in a lake, and the effects that you can make are minimal. But when you live in a smaller community, like the one I grew up in and like the one I live in now, you know your neighbors, you know the people around you, you know their needs better, and you can help them in the ways that they need to be helped versus the ways you just think they need to be helped. And and I think that for me personally, her story just reminds me of that, right? Like,
yeah,
she did just enough to tick the dial, turn the dial just a little bit, right? And if everybody just turned the dial just a little bit in the positive direction, how much more would our communities be positively changed? I think for me, that's one of the reasons that history is so important, and telling these stories are so important. And I'm thankful that I came across your book because of that. So thank you for writing this book. I really got a lot out of it.
Yeah, I'm so glad. I'm so glad it resonated. And I think, you know, it's an interesting book to write, I think, as someone who didn't grow up in Alabama, because in a way it was easier for me because I could see sort of what was special about it. And I think sometimes when you grow up in a place, it's harder to see what makes it special or makes it different from other places because it's all you know, you know. So, yeah, it was just a pleasure to write. And I mean, you know, just like we said earlier, the best part was just going out and talking to people and hearing their stories. And, you know, as soon as I open my mouth, people know that I'm not from here. And yet they still were happy to talk to me, happy to welcome me to all of their events and teach me what was going on. And just, I mean, I just experienced so much warmth from Alabamians while researching this book. And that's something that I will definitely take with me, you know, forever.
Now, this book came out in 2019, but you had another book right behind it, a fiction book, a middle grades book, called Like Nothing Amazing Ever Happened. Just came out in 2020, right? Just this year?
Yeah.
Just April. In time for the pandemic to happen and your book tour to be shut down. I'm assuming that you had big plans to travel and tell everyone about it.
Yeah, it was a challenging time to have a book come out. But, you know, to be honest, I think the silver lining, if you can call it that, of COVID, is that it forced all of us to slow down and take stock and, at least for me, figure out, you know, what's really important, what do we need to be doing versus what have we just kind of fallen into. And I had a lot of fun being out on the road with the food book and did a lot of presentations and traveled a lot and really enjoyed it. But when I was, you know, about 6 or 9 months into that, I was pretty tired. So it was actually, it was nice to stay home and regroup. And that part of it was kind of a blessing. But yeah, I have two fiction books that are intended for middle grade. Of course, adults can read them too, but writing has always been kind of my outlet. You know, I've always written, I've always read, and so it's been really cool to be able to write something and see it get out into the world.
So this fiction book, which I read, I'm an adult, and I loved it. I thought it was fabulous. And I can't wait for my daughter to read it. She's in middle school, and I think it's I think it's a fantastic book for middle school kids. This is about a middle school boy and his life changing experience of losing his father. I thought it was really powerful, and I think there are some real correlations between your Alabama book and this book, even though it's set in your home state of Minnesota. And I think where I really saw the parallels was in knowing our history. I think that was one of the things that I drew out of. I think it was good to have read the Alabama book first and then the fiction
That's
book
so
second, because I could see those layers. Did you intend that?
No, but I think the experience of digging so deep into Alabama history made me realize that I knew very little about Minnesota history. I mean, you know, I just didn't really know much about where I grew up, which is crazy. I mean, I guess it makes sense because as a kid, you're just not really paying attention to that kind of thing, you know? And I think it is when we get older that we become more interested in our history and our genealogy and our, you know, our families and everything. So I set the book, I just wanted to set it in my hometown. And this is, you know, getting back to my point about giving authors maybe too much credit about their ideas. Like you just have one tiny little spark of an idea and follow it and see where it goes, you know? And so I certainly didn't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to do this in this book and this in this book. And, you know, it was just, I want to set it in my hometown and I want it to be a boy, because my previous fiction book had been a girl protagonist, and I want him to be dealing with something that kind of sets him apart. And that's all I knew at the beginning. And just by sort of following him through his story, that Minnesota history part kind of got folded in there. And I think that's just because I'm really interested in history all the time. And so that was just a natural progression. But it was really fun for me to learn the history of my hometown, because I didn't really know it. I just knew the broad strokes.
You spent some time getting into the history of the native populations in Minnesota and their stories, and how, and I think you even just alluded to it, talking about your own experience, we don't pay attention to the things around us, especially when we're young, but even as adults, we just don't pay attention, and we like simple answers, and we like simple things, and we like everything to fit in a little box, because it just helps us make sense of the world. And when things are complicated, when things are sad or difficult or challenge our worldview, we don't really want to deal with that. So I really appreciated that complexity and that those layers that you dug through in this story.
Thank you. I'm glad that came through. It's an interesting endeavor to write a book for middle grade, because you know, you have to really stay in that world. But so you can't get too adult about it or too philosophical, you know, because this is a book that's supposed to speak to middle grade readers. But I love that challenge, because I think kids are capable of so much depth and have so much depth going on in their inner lives, you know, more than we know and more than we think. And so it's been nice to be able to bring that out. I think, you know, Justin, the main character of this book, he's, because he lost his dad, he's asking all the big questions. Mm. And, you know, nobody has the answers. And I think that's kind of one of the central themes, is that, you know, you do the best you can with what you got. And like you said, nothing gets wrapped up neatly in the end. You just kind of look for those little points of strength and those little moments of hope, and take, you know, strength from the people around you. But yeah, I think that age is kind of, even without a death, I think kids start, they ask those big questions and they think about those big questions. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to just go there with them, you know, because they're mm-hmm. already thinking about it. So
as I was reading it, I'm trying to put myself in the reader, like in a young reader's perspective, right? And like you said, they're trying to make sense of their world. And I think so often, at least culturally, we try to make sense of everything, that everything has to have a certain meaning or a certain purpose or a certain reason why it happened. And sometimes things just happen because they happen. If we don't develop a skill at a young age to deal with those types of loose ends, I think it gets harder in our life when we see more tragedy, when we, as things start to build up, it gets harder to deal with those things. And I thought that was a really nice tool that you used, not tying up all the loose ends, not fixing everything at the end of the book, and having Justin have to live in these two worlds of knowing and not knowing.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have plans for another book?
Yeah, I'm always, you know, working on something. I'd like to do another middle grade, and I've got kind of some ideas working on that. I'd really love to do another nonfiction book, though. Mm. And so I'm always kind of listening. And I just started about 6 months ago as director of the Alabama Folklife Association, which is a statewide arts nonprofit in Alabama. And so that helps me too, just kind of have a pulse on, you know, what's going on and different stories that are out there. And so I'd love to sort of find something that hasn't been fully explored yet, mm-hmm. and do another nonfiction book too. You know, I like writing of all kinds. So
I think one of the most powerful parts of your book was actually your note at the end of the book. It reminded me of how important it is to give kids an opportunity to be creative and express themselves. You talked about your own love of dance, and you talked mm-hmm. about inspiration that you had received from dance. And you talked about how you like inspiring people to use or find that creative spark in writing. Do you hope that as you do your books and you do your tours and you talk to students, do you get an opportunity to, I guess, share that with them?
Yeah, actually, after I did my first book, I did a lot of talks. That one came out in 2017, and it was also a middle grade. And so I got to go to a lot of middle grade classrooms. And it was one of the best parts about having that book come out, because, you know, I think life for kids these days can get really competitive. And I don't want that to inhibit them from being creative. You know, they're judged so much at school and by their peers and by their parents even. And so to me, I think having any kind of creative impulse, you know, whether it's writing or painting or gardening, or, I mean, creativity comes in so many forms, you know, having a platform to encourage them to use that, even if they don't understand it, even if they don't think it's good, even if they don't know where it's going or it doesn't fit on their resume or whatever, you know, that's a really important piece of who they are, and it's worth exploring. Mm. You know, and for me, I think the creativity has not only given me an outlet, but just kind of opened up a lot of just interesting worlds and thoughts. And, you know, I hate to think of kids who don't have a creative outlet, because I think it does so many different things for us. But the main, you know, one of the main messages I give them is, you know, just try not to judge your own stuff so harshly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, you know, you're doing it because you can't not do it. You're doing it because it's what you have. And it's kind of the same conversation we were having about the food book. Like, you figure out what you have and you bring it into the world, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I guess it is kind of a consistent message across these different books is, you know, kind of your, whatever you have to say, whatever you've been given is enough, and it's worth hearing, mm-hmm. you know, however you choose to express it.
I really like that as a point of encouragement and inspiration, is that in the same way that we like things to be in a little box and be simple, we also think that everything we do has to be like a final product, that we're working right. on some final, that if I'm sketching or if I'm drawing, I have to have a finished piece in order for it to have been worth it. Right. Or that, and this was one of the sentiments in the fiction story, is that we're just on this journey toward knowing, is one of the quotes from your book that stuck with me. That we can never know everything, but yet it's that experience of pursuing something, of learning something, of being on the journey is the most rewarding part.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if in the creative realm, you know, like you're saying, if you put too much pressure on it, it destroys the process, and mm-hmm. you might as well not do it. So yeah, exactly. If you write something, I tell kids, if you write a whole page and there's only like one line that you like, fine, mm-hmm. you know, take that line and go somewhere else, or just keep the line just because you like it. You know, I mean, it's not all about being perfect or finishing, or, you know, it's about the process. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd like to see more kids, be encouraged to just write. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and one of the things that this person was saying is that, we think, and as we're thinking and we're listening to our thoughts, or our thoughts are just rolling around in our heads, like, we think we're actually forming ideas and sentences. But that's easy, right? Like, just letting those thoughts roll around. But when you actually mm-hmm. try to put those thoughts on paper, that's hard. Mm-hmm. And the real beauty and the real magic is what happens when you try to put your words on paper. And so I hope that kids and adults who read your books will come away being inspired to put their words onto paper and to try to tell a story, even if it's a simple story, because I definitely felt that when I was finished reading, that just starting with an idea and working that story out, we all have that ability.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm really glad that came through, because that's exactly what I wanted to say, you know, that everybody has that spark, and don't be fooled into thinking that, you know, artists or writers or whoever just sit down and you just pound it out and it's, you know, you have a plan. It's just, like you said, you're just following the little rabbit trail.
Well, Emily, I enjoyed this conversation, and I hope we can have another one when your next book comes out. And
yes, thank you so much for having me. It's been so fun.
It's been awesome. It's been a lot of fun. Where can my listeners find out more about you and your writing?
Well, I have a website that will have all of my books and writing on it. That's just my name, emilyblavos.com. But you can find my books. You should be able to order them through your independent bookstore. And of course, you know, they're all on Amazon in the world of Amazon and COVID. so they're definitely not hard to find.
Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Adam. Thanks for having me.